therefore could deport them. Speaking shortly after being released, the European Union national, who requested anonymity, told the Observer, "They're trying to play with mine and my family's lives, and it's not fair. I'm supposed to have rights." Pierre McLouf, legal director of Bail for Immigration Detainees, said, "It seems that the Home Office has pre-decided the fate of certain EU nationals, perhaps believing that they are easy to remove. But in its drive to deport more people, it is sidestepping legal requirements and legal procedures." Pierre McLouf said, "Whether this is due to administrative or willful neglect may be unclear, but by ignoring the legal steps that EU nationals have undertaken to assert their rights, the United Kingdom is in breach of its duties under the withdrawal agreement." The issue appears to relate mostly to applications sent by post instead of forwarded digitally. Aranea Kugulathas, a barrister and legal manager of Bail for Immigration Detainees, European Economic Area Project, said paper applications were used by many vulnerable and marginalized people, including the elderly and those in detention or prison who found it difficult to access a computer or didn't have access to a valid identity document. The numbers affected could be significant. For instance, out of 1,500 inmates at Wandsworth Prison in South London, almost 500 are believed to be European Union nationals. Aranea Kugulathas, a barrister and legal manager of Bail for Immigration Detainees, European Economic Area Project, said, "Despite having made applications, settled status applications, European Economic Area nationals are being deprived of their liberty and even served with removal directions, both of which they are forced to challenge despite limited access to legal advice and legal representation." She added, "These challenges are particularly difficult for those detained under immigration powers in prisons, some of whom are locked in their cells for around 23 hours a day or more due to the pandemic. Aware of such difficulties, ministers have promised an indefinite period where people who had not applied would be allowed to do so if they had reasonable grounds." Among the cases known to Bail for Immigration Detainees are one where the Home Office failed to acknowledge a settled status application submitted in mid-July, stating that there were no barriers to his removal and removal directions are to be set soon. Another case involved a European Union citizen who, despite submitting a settled status application online, still received removal directions from the Home Office. The UK Home Office spokesperson rejected the charges as baseless and, despite a number of cases featured in the article, have been contested by the Home Office in immigration tribunals, the latest of which occurred on Friday, 30th of July. Claimed the Observer had failed to provide any proof whatsoever that detention or removal directions are being served to those with settled status, to those with EUSS settlement scheme status. They claimed, "Our approach means that should immigration enforcement encounter anyone with EUSS but who may be eligible, we will work with them to enable them to apply and signpost them to available support. If someone has applied to the European Union settlement scheme by 30th of June deadline but has not had a decision yet, their rights are protected until their application is decided."
Dark Review.
Hello and welcome to Doc Review with me, Camelia Shambayati. In today's show, we're discussing Shadow World, directed by Johan Grumman-Prez. And joining me in the studio, we have Maria Duarte, who is a film critic for the Morning Star newspaper and who has also worked as a news journalist. And beside her is Tete Kopi, who is a journalist and broadcaster. Now, Shadow World gives you an alarming behind-the-scenes tale of the global arms trade, revealing the complicity of the US and British governments working with corrupt regimes in the world and how this determines economic and foreign policies, undermines democracy, and creates widespread suffering. And in shedding light on how our realities are being constructed, the film also offers a way for audiences to see through this horror in the hopes of creating a better future.
I've got nothing against money. I don't mind paying bribes to politicians. The thing about politicians is that they're very much like prostitutes, but only more expensive.
The heads of government are the salespeople in chief of their country's large arms contractors.
For the last 50 years at least, policy has been made based on the assumption of greed, and it's ruined the world.
This very phrase, war on terror, it's nonsense. It's like saying a war on war. You're slipping into this possibility of kind of perpetual war.
The national security state not only seeks a perpetual state of war, it will even go to all ends to create that.
They make the mafia look like a bunch of schoolboys.
And it destroys diplomacy. It destroys the will to diplomacy, and it destroys the skill for diplomacy.
Bombs, they're like food. Munitions, that's got, you know, sell-by date. You gotta get rid of it.
Blair came to South Africa to lobby that BAE, the British weapons manufacturer, won the biggest contract, $10 billion. Quite scarce public resources on this weaponry that we didn't need.
BAE had channeled international covert payments all over the world to the local politicians.
Seems to be a very expensive way of organising bribe payment. Might as well cut out the military equipment and just hand out the money.
It's the disease of permanent war that destroyed the Middle East, not Islamic fundamentalism.
Companies are not only sort of part of the government, but they're effectively above the law.
It's okay to kill from a distance without a warrant, without a trial, without a jury, and the execution takes place on screen.
Once you start a war, you open a kind of Pandora's box. You don't control it, it controls you. And it propels you in directions you never thought you'd go.
Well, first of all, a very warm welcome to you both. Thanks very much for coming on. So this documentary was a very politically charged film and also very eye-opening and covers a lot of ground about the global arms industry, which is a trillion-dollar industry. Maria, if I could start with you as our guest film critic, what's your take on Shadow World?
Well, it's a very detailed, comprehensive look at the exploration of the arms deal, which seems to rally its audience into political action. I didn't feel that it did anything particularly shattering. But what it did was it kind of crossed the T's and dotted the I's. And then it also tried to be a bit sort of poetic. So you have all these numerous talking heads, but they're peppered with these poetic and melodic extracts from Eduardo Galeano's stories. And in that way, the filmmaker trying to make it somewhat more cinematic because it is a lot to digest.
And of course, it could serve as a comprehensive guide to those who don't know much about this topic.
No, exactly. It's not quite the idiot's guide to arms deal, but it is very intelligently done, very exquisitely edited, and it does give you sort of a very potted history at the issues behind it.
And Tete, if I could turn to you now, what was your take on this film?
Well, trying to understand the arms industry and actually the way of real politics today without watching this film is like trying to understand Hamlet without a crib sheet. You don't understand the language, you don't understand the idioms, you don't understand the context within which everything is being done, so you probably won't have comprehension. I found this
film... Of course,
film
that's a lot to ask to squeeze into a 90-odd minute film.
Well, and I always ask myself first, look, did he need 90 minutes? And I think, yes, he did, and he used the 90 minutes extremely well. Because ultimately, for any cinematic experience, I walk away with what was the impact. The impact was I'm really pleased I had breakfast before I watched this movie, because I felt a little bit dirty after watching it. A little bit like
watching... And why was that?
Because all of it was so kind of resonant with me of why things are in the world they are today. And it's happening in broad daylight.
And of course, you were saying how there were talking heads in this, but they weren't just any talking heads. They were very high-profile interviews. You had top journalists like Robert Fisk, senior American politicians.
Yes, and you also had that arms dealer, which apparently was very difficult to get hold of an arms dealer to come onto the into the film, because the director said that the first rough cut was 4.5 hours long, and he'd interviewed 50 people and kind of condensed it to 15. But with people like the arms dealer, it kind of adds more, it adds colour, because at the end of the day, they are just talking heads.
I mean, at the beginning, what absolutely got me bolt upright was a banal statement like, actually, when you're doing an arms deal, your secretary's ass could give you the edge. Then later on in the clip you showed, where he said that politicians are like prostitutes, it's just that they're a little bit more expensive. It's the banality of that world which actually ordinary people in the street cannot believe can be happening in the world of multi-million dollar corporations and the heads of state who we voted to put in place.
Mm. So Shadow World's an apt name indeed for the documentary.
This is an impressive crowd, the haves and the have-mores.
Cheney commissioned a study by Halliburton to find out how much more of the Defense Department could be privatized.
Halliburton, proud to serve our troops.
Halliburton was elated to get this $1 million contract and, of course, returned a verdict that, oh, Mr. Secretary, lots more of it can be privatized.
Dick Cheney leaves the Defense Department and goes and heads Halliburton himself. And he spends the entire 1990s building up the Halliburton war empire.
Well, if we're going to talk about Star Wars, we might as well invite Darth Vader. And I'm happy to accept.
Then he comes back into power as vice president, and then they start hiring Halliburton to, you know, in advance even of U.S. troops going into Iraq, Halliburton personnel and equipment was being deployed to the Gulf. It's hard to look at this and not say these guys had a very long-term plan for how they were going to increase the powerful infrastructure of private companies. What we've essentially done is to create a network of corporations that have the firepower of small nation states that could, you know, overthrow some small governments around the world.
In essence, we in the United States have privatized the ultimate public function, war.
After watching this documentary, really, you believe there's no such thing as coincidences. Marie, what was your reaction to watching the connections being made between the US military, the government, and oil companies? And what else does the documentary suggest about the ulterior motives of the government?
Well, part of me was shocked. Part of me was resigned to this hideous, dark shadow world as it's described, and that we have no power to do anything about it because all this is done behind closed doors, you know. It's all about sweeteners and kickbacks. And as it said in the film, that war is a commodity. And it doesn't matter how many people die, the longer it lasts, the more money people make, whether it be at the top of government or, you know, these arms dealers. It's disgusting. It's appalling. And you do feel dirty afterwards, but you kind of feel powerless. And the film doesn't really give you an alternative.
Perhaps there is no alternative in real life there.
Maybe not. Of course, now, with the Trump administration, we would hope that there isn't that secrecy because he does everything via Twitter and we have the biggest arms deal, and put that in inverted commas because he hasn't said that. But, you know, back in the Reagan era and Thatcher and all those, it was all done secretively.
Which is highlighted in the documentary.
Yeah, and even up to Obama, which that was quite surprising. surprising, but not, because it's government, so they can do whatever they want, really.
And Tete, if I could turn to you, would you agree with what Maria said, and what did you make of these connections being made?
Very much. I mean, I split the movie, The Doc, into three parts. Part one was the arrant vulgarity and banality of it, with the arms dealer making those statements about politicians and prostitutes, things like that. The bit where they showed a whole Saudi sultan being given a commercial airliner, and the banality of him painting it in his favourite American football colours. I mean, if I was a Man U supporter, I'd have liveried it up in red, for example. Then the second part is that it goes into the culture and the rationales which are given to enable this to happen, and the institutions that support that culture, which is what we've just basically watched. Now, I could not help but expand this documentary into history. And I place at the start point towards the civilization we have now reached at the start of the transatlantic slave trade. Because this was the first time an activity, slavery, has been known since the dawn of civilization. But this was the first time it was actually industrialized. And with the industrialization, you had to create a philosophy and a culture which enabled it to go on, fly in plain sight with the support of ordinary people. And this is the bit that this documentary does so extremely well.
Well, that's a fascinating point.
I denounce the call to invade Iraq publicly. The New York Times issued me a formal written reprimand, which is what you get before you're fired under union rules to stop speaking out against the war. I'd been the Middle East bureau chief. I mean, I'd been in Iraq, been 7 years in the Middle East. How can you come out of Gaza and not be angry? What's being done to those people? How can you come out of, you know, the Sudan, El Salvador, dozens of other places I've been, and not be angry? I've seen the bodies of a lot of children, which I can't forget. You know, especially having done it for 20 years, Dostoevsky said, hell is the inability to love, and that's what kills people. I fully get why people blow their brains out. It's really hell. And I don't use love as a kind of hallmark, schmaltzy, you know, we all gotta love each other. I'm saying that the only way you're healed from those experiences is by reestablishing a connection with that kind of power, with another human being. And if you can't do that, you don't survive. And I have friends who couldn't do it. They're not here anymore.
Very emotional account there. Maria, do you get a sense from this documentary that there is a lot of frustration and a lack of support for these ongoing wars?
Well, there is, but the problem is, and what the governments do so insidiously, is to instill terror and fear into the populace. And so that gives them carte blanche to do what they want militarily. And so people sort of believe what the government tells them. And so we're in this vicious circle that correspondents, brave correspondents, like you've just seen, try to get the truth out there. And they're literally, you know, smacked down, and they try to gag them. Mm. And that's appalling, and it shouldn't happen, but it does, and it's still happening today.
And it's, it reminds me, actually, Claire Short, former Labour politician, she says that the war on terror is sort of almost like a manufactured concept to keep the sort of perpetual wars, and it's sort of used as a scapegoat. Would you agree with that,
Tessie? Well, a marketing man's dream is a product that creates demand for itself. It becomes a perpetual motion machine, and you can't stop it. And I call this part of the documentary the state capture bit. That's the expression we actually use in South Africa for when private people latch onto the state and leech off it, because that's what's happened with the arms companies and their lobbyists, is that actually they are running the state. And that's why the arms dealer can say that the politicians don't run anything, they're just more expensive than prostitutes. It's the banality of that. And I think that at the end, this documentary works because of the sense of outrage. It can fire up in people. Some people will also just feel, what's the point? I give up. We don't stand a chance. But many, many people will be outraged just by being able to join the dots of the fact that these private contractors have got a stranglehold on government. And actually what government does is as a result of what is profitable to the contractor. And some of the governments, of course, people are corrupt. Imagine the ANC taking that massive... Taking that massive kickback when hundreds of thousands of poor, ordinary Africans' lives could have been saved with retroviral drugs. But they went for that because the ANC wanted to stay around.
Well, going back to the documentary, and a really fascinating point you made, there's four main targets, I suppose, of the documentary seems to be the US, the UK, Saudi Arabia, and Israel. How are the four countries portrayed in this documentary, Maria, and how are they connected?
Well, they're not portrayed terribly well, really, because they're in it for the money. You've seen Blair, who brought in new labour and was, you know, the spiritual light here who's going to bring all this hope. And yet, you know, he was in it for the money. He was getting, kickbacks and stuff, allegedly. But what was interesting there is that the influence that the Saudi royal family had on him, and where you had Prince Bandar come over and say, hold on, the serious fraud... having this investigation into these crimes, and they were getting very close to him, and he said, no, you need to stop this, otherwise we're going to remove the security and there's going to be blood on the streets of London. And then you have Blair turning round, and basically the guy says, jump, and Blair says, well, how high, more or less. That's disgusting, really.
And he
got away with it, but then he was, you know, Teflon Tody, you know, nothing stuck to him. And it's the same with all the other countries. You know, what surprised me was that they didn't look at the drone warfare, which is, and also cyber warfare, which is now becoming...
They're documentaries in their own right.
Exactly, and we've probably covered that already. But yes, no, and the thing is that all these countries, nothing kind of surprised me about it, that they were all interlinked. They don't come out very well from the documentary, and if you didn't think well of them, then it will compound what you thought. It's speaking to the converted, really.
Fiscal year 1999, 2.3 trillion missing. Fiscal year 2000, 1.1 trillion missing. The Pentagon has claimed year after year that the reason it can't account for the money is because its computers don't communicate with each other.
$1 trillion $1 bills stacked high would reach nearly 68,000 miles into space, one-third of the way to the moon.
I got a phone call from the FBI saying that I was a target of a death threat. And that's what happens when you go against the big boys.
Who has the contracts today to make those systems communicate with each other? And how much have the taxpayers paid for them?
There are times that corporations do things they should not do, in which case they tend to be suspended for some period. There are times then that corporations can get out of the penalty box, if you will.
This company was never in the penalty box. If you could proceed to my second question, please.
I've forgotten what the second question was.
Individuals operating in the shadows and never having their names called are able to leverage the power of the military and the foreign policy apparatus for their own personal pecuniary ends.
What now? Who's the enemy? How do we justify?
What better new enemy than an hypothetical invisible enemy called the War on Terror?
Rumsfeld looked quite smug and incompetent there. Maria, I heard you laugh during that clip. Why was that?
Because he wasn't incompetent. He knew exactly what he was doing, and he knew he could get away with it. And he has. You know, it was the one that was then ostracised and found it very difficult later on in her career. So these people get away with it. That's the problem. And it's wrong, but but what can you do? What can we do?
And Tessie, would you agree with Maria? How do you think of how Rumsfeld was portrayed in the documentary, and was it accurate depiction?
Well, the funny thing, when I was watching it, I actually thought it took me back to one of the scenes in the Godfather movies, when the mafia bosses are lined up in front of I think it was a grand jury or a commission of some sort, and the smugness with which they behave literally said that whoever's asking the questions, I own your boss. So, and it's the confidence of knowing that he could pull her leash in at any time that he wanted, and sure enough, she's got death threats by the FBI. Whether they're true or false, it's almost lethal pressure to make sure that these people comply. It's extremely difficult, but I actually feel that you can over-egg the pudding to a point, and with the confluence of certain events in world affairs, the nationalism that's rising in Europe, Brexit that's happened in Britain, Trump and all the excesses that he is associated with, I think actually we have reached a turning point in which many of these old ways will not be able to function in the way they did before.
So this documentary raises greater and greater questions and makes us question society. Do you think this is a testament to the documentary then, Maria?
I think so. Like I said earlier, it doesn't really reveal anything new, but
it's certainly thought-provoking.
But it's thought-provoking, and it makes you think, and it kind of joins all the dots, basically, because we knew all this. But when you see it there in black and white, or in colour, it's slightly different, and it does make you really angry. You know, you end up screaming at the screen, because it's so frustrating that these people, on the face of it, got away with it. And
so, just a final thought from the film?
But you see, the interesting thing is that there is another documentary that follows this, which will have to put the last piece of the jigsaw in place, which is that actually our collective standard of living is built on the excesses we're seeing in this movie. And it is, I think, when that story is told, that people will connect the fact that actually there isn't so much of an otherness around somebody who behaves like a gangster in creating public policy, and the car that I'm driving on the street, and the fact that my salary is what it is. All of this thing has a cyclical kind of connection, and people will start to join those dots as well.
Very powerful note to end it on, and I'm afraid we'll have to leave it there as we've run out of time. And that's it for this episode of Doc Review. Thank you both to my guests and to you. I've been Camila Shambayati, and see you on the next episode of Doc Review.
Follow us on social media to stay up to date on the latest global developments. You can keep in touch with us by following us on Twitter at twitter.com/parstodayen. You can also follow IRIB English Radio on Instagram via instagram.com/parstodayenglish.
the limelight.
At least five people have been wounded and holidaymakers evacuated after wildfires devastated a pine wood near a beach in Pescara, Italy, as one of the worst heat waves in decades swept across southeastern Europe. A five-year-old girl was taken to hospital, but her condition is not believed to be life-threatening, according to reports. The article you're about to hear has been written by the Observer journalist Lorenzo Tondo. The piece is titled, Tourists Evacuated from Pescara as Italy Records More Than 800 Wildfires. Five people have been wounded and holidaymakers evacuated after wildfires devastated a pine wood near a beach in Pescara, Italy, as one of the worst heat waves in decades swept across southeastern Europe. A five-year-old girl was taken to hospital, but her condition is not believed to be life-threatening, according to reports. About 800 people were evacuated from their homes, including a convent of nuns, after a fire broke out in the 53-hectare, 131-acre Pineta Donunziana Nature Reserve, as the fires continued to be active on different fronts. We had to evacuate several homes and beach resorts due to the smoke, said Carlo Maschi, the mayor of Pescara. The biggest problem is the hot wind. We're doing the best we can to limit the damage. More than 800 flare-ups were recorded this weekend, mainly in the south of Italy, according to Italy's National Fire Service. In the last 24 hours, firefighters have carried out more than 800 interventions, 250 in Sicily, 130 in Puglia and Calabria, 90 in Lazio, and 70 in Campania, the service tweeted. Wildfires have also broken out across much of southeastern Europe, including in Spain, Greece, and Turkey. The three countries are dealing with one of the most severe heat waves in decades, with temperatures rising above 40 degrees Celsius, 104 degrees Fahrenheit, forcing hundreds of people to evacuate. According to European Union data, this year's fire season has been significantly more destructive than average. More than 200 people were taken to safety from the seaside around Catania in Sicily, while dozens of villagers were evacuated in tourist hotspots in southern Turkey, where wildfires that have killed 8 people raged on for a fifth day. Fanned by soaring temperatures and strong winds, with experts saying that the global heating increases the frequency and intensity of such blazes, Turkey is suffering its worst fires in at least 10 years. With nearly 95,000 hectares of land burnt so far this year, compared with an average of 13,500 hectares at the same point in the years between 2008 and 2020. A neighborhood in the tourist city of Bodrum has been evacuated, according to a report by Turkish media, as strong winds fanned flames from the nearby Milas district. Unable to leave by road, 540 residents were taken to hotels by boats. People were also evacuated from the resort city of Antalya, and 2 bodies were found in that region on Sunday, taking the number of people killed so far to 8. Turkey's Defense Ministry released satellite images showing the extent of the damage, with forest areas turned black and smoke still visible. Turkish President Recep Tayyip Erdogan has been criticized after it emerged that Turkey has no firefighting planes, even though one-third of its territory is forested, and wildfires are becoming increasingly frequent. Meanwhile, a major blaze broke out early on Saturday near Patras in western Greece. 5 villagers have been evacuated and 8 people were hospitalized with burns and respiratory problems in the region, which remains on alert. The mayor of the nearby village of Aegialias, Dimitris Kalogeropoulos, called it an immense catastrophe. "We slept outside overnight, terrified that we would not have a house when we woke up," a resident of Lambiri told Greek television. In Spain, dozens of firefighters backed by water-dropping aircraft were battling a wildfire that broke out on Saturday, 31st of July, near the San Juan Reservoir, about 40 miles east of Madrid, the Spanish capital.
An Israeli petroleum products tanker managed by Israeli-owned Zodiac Maritime came under attack off the coast of Oman on Thursday. The London-based company later claimed that 2 crewmen, a Briton and a Romanian, had been killed in the assault. The US, Israel and their allies rushed to point the finger at Iran for the attack, while the official investigation has only begun and is not completed yet. Meanwhile, a source close to the resistance axis said the attack on the Mercer Street tanker was a retaliation for Israeli aggression in Syria, particularly the latest attack on Davao Airport that left 2 resistant forces dead. In recent months, several other Israeli ships have been targeted in various maritime routes across the world. Earlier in the month, a fire broke out on an Israeli-owned cargo ship after it was struck by an unidentified weapon in the northeastern Indian Ocean. Back in February, an Israeli-owned ship was hit by an explosion in the Sea of Oman. In April, another Israeli ship came under attack off the coast of the UAE.
Resistance access won't permit Israelis to commit any crimes without retaliation, whether from the Yemen or Lebanon or Syria or Palestine or Tehran or any place of the resistance axis. So I guess they have to expect that the resistance forces can reach them anywhere. So they are playing a losing game with the resistance axis, whether when they attack at Syrian borders or the Iraq-Syrian borders or at Tehran when they commit assassinations or do any aggressions against this power. Now the balance of power is for the sake or for the interest of the access of resistance.
The retaliatory attack has exposed the vulnerability of Israeli entities in the region and sent a strong message to Israel that the resistance front will not allow the Tel Aviv regime to commit crimes with impunity. Western countries have condemned the latest attack on the Israeli-owned ship off the Oman coast, while they have always shut their eyes to Israel's crimes. Thousands of Syrians have died since the outbreak of the Western-backed war in 2011, and millions more are suffering due to the crippling sanctions and economic war imposed on Syria by the US government. That's why Washington's ally, the occupying regime of Israel, has attacked Syria on a continual basis. Also, the Syrian government blames the Israeli regime and its Western regional allies for aiding Takfiri terrorist groups wreaking havoc in the country. The latest attacks on Israeli ships come against the backdrop of Tel Aviv's various assaults on cargo ships across the Persian Gulf region and elsewhere. A Wall Street Journal report in March revealed that Israel had systematically struck at least 12 Iranian ships. Israel is also responsible for several instances of acts of sabotage against Iran's nuclear program over the past decade, including attacks on Iran's nuclear facilities and assassination of its scientists.
A root cause of the tension, the deplorable level of tension in the Middle East that the world has been witness to for many decades now, is the fact that Israel acts with impunity. Israel is given a blank check, so to speak, year on year from Washington and London to do as it pleases in the Middle East. If America and Britain truly respected international law, if they truly respected the Charter of the United Nations, and if they truly respected the concept of state sovereignty, then they would put an end to Israel's flagrant violations of international law.
The international community's silence in the face of Tel Aviv's crimes is a result of the U.S. shielding of the illegitimate regime of Israel. Tel Aviv has for long been able to get away with its crimes without any prosecution. However, the latest move by the resistance axis shows that Tel Aviv's hit-and-run tactic is no longer useful. Now, it must face the music and taste its own medicine.
On Thursday, Israel attained observer status at the African Union after nearly 20 years of lobbying. Making the move official, Israeli ambassador to Ethiopia, Burundi, and Chad presented his credentials to Moussa Faki Mohammed, the chairman of the African Union Commission, at the bloc's headquarters in the Ethiopian capital, Addis Ababa.
But for African countries, Palestine is now no longer a priority. Unfortunately, for some Arab countries that have turned their back to Palestine, this is the same.
The move was met with harsh criticism from Palestinian resistance groups and several African nations. In a letter to the chairperson of the African Union, head of Hamas political wing Ismail Haniyeh said the decision contradicts the principles of the organization. He added that the move deals a heavy blow to the Palestinian people and their legitimate rights. Haniyeh called on Faki to reverse the decision, indicating that it does not reflect the truth of the stance of the Union toward the Palestinian cause. South Africa also fiercely objected to the move by the Union. It said the AU Commission made the decision unilaterally without consulting its members.
Now, none of the member states were officially consulted, except those that are probably pro-Israeli. The pro-Israeli ones are well known. It's Kenya, it's Tanzania, it's Rwanda, Togo, Cameroon. These are the countries that are backing this move.
The South African Foreign Ministry has called the AU's move, quote, incomprehensible and inexplicable. The South African government said the African Union's decision is even more shocking in a year in which oppressed people of Palestine were hounded by destructive bombardments and continued illegal settlements of the land. It was referring to Israel's 11-day war on the Gaza Strip in May that killed over 250 Palestinians, including 66 children. The war broke out after the regime's decision to evict several Palestinian families from their homes in the East Al-Quds neighborhood of Sheikh Jarrah.
Now, South Africa has been preceded by Algeria, and in Algeria a week ago was up in arms at this decision without having been consulted, and said it was contrary to the charter of the Africa Union, that the charter does not allow apartheid states, a state that practices racism as its official policy, to be part of as an observer, and that commits atrocities against an occupied population. And today, Namibia has joined South Africa.
Israel previously held observer status in the predecessor organization of African Unity until 2002, when the organization was disbanded and replaced by the AU. Pro-Palestine language is typically featured in statements delivered at the AU's annual summits. Palestine already has observer status at the African Union. Besides, the United States, Israel's closest ally, also operates in Africa under the pretext of fighting terrorism there. However, local sources say civilians have been the main victims of the attacks conducted by U.S. forces.
In fact, even in southern, on the southern border of Syria, in the Quneitra region, Daesh and Jabhat al-Nusra, who are terrorist organization fighting against the Syrian government, have been aided both militarily, financially, logistically by Israel. So, I mean, this is, of course, just diplomatic talk.
That underlines the risk for Africa to have a possible Israeli military presence, as the Israeli regime is already facing a probe over war crimes committed in the Gaza Strip and the occupied West Bank.
Ties between the United States and Russia are far worse than strained. The two have been on a confrontational path for a very long time. Tensions have been deteriorating over the past years after a series of tit-for-tat actions that have left bilateral diplomatic ties in tatters. Such tit-for-tat actions, like consulate closures or expulsions of diplomats, have made it difficult to even conduct basic bilateral diplomacy. The lack of proper diplomatic contacts between the two rivals has increased the risk of miscalculation that could lead to a potential disaster. Recently, Russia's top diplomat warned that tensions between Washington and Moscow were getting close to a dangerous confrontation. The two sides say they want to prevent any such scenario. This week, diplomats from the U.S. and Russia sat down for talks on strategic stability. The talks in Geneva were arranged in June when U.S. President Joe Biden met his Russian counterpart Vladimir Putin. Moscow and Washington have deep differences over a host of issues, including the situation in Ukraine, arms control, human rights, and cybersecurity. Observers believe such differences have their roots in the geopolitical rivalry between the two major nuclear-armed states.
I think that what's happened in the last 20 years under Putin's basic leadership, I think, for the last 20 years, has been a resurgence of Russian power, of Russian technology, of the place of Russia in the world. And as a major country, the United States doesn't like that.
Can the ongoing diplomatic effort help reduce tensions and pave the way for cooperation? The meeting on Wednesday was the first in a series of planned talks aimed at enhancing communication and reduce the possibility of missteps. The delegations were headed by U.S. Deputy Secretary of State Wendy Sherman and the Russian Deputy Foreign Minister Sergei Rybakov. The U.S. side called the discussions professional and substantive. The Russians said they were satisfied with the conclusions and that America showed readiness for constructive dialogue. But despite the positive signs, controversial comments by the U.S. president drew condemnation from Moscow. In an address to national intelligence officers, Joe Biden accused Russia of trying to interfere in the 2022 U.S. midterm elections. He warned that an escalation in cyber attacks could lead to war. Biden also said Russia has nuclear weapons and oil wells and nothing else to earn money from. The U.S. president claimed this economic weakness makes Russia even more unpredictable and dangerous. The Russians were quick to respond. The Kremlin said Biden's statements showed America's erroneous understanding of modern Russia. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov said Moscow regrets that America is more of an adversary than a partner, despite the Russian government showing political will to normalize ties. Observers believe the latest exchanges further reveal the depth of distrust and deep differences between Washington and Moscow.
Russians have begun to reassert their normal geographic dominance in the area. And in particular, this was true with Ukraine. And, you know, so can you imagine the situation if the Russians had on the Canadian border, you know, an army? We would freak out. Well, the Russians feel the same way about NATO being in the middle of Europe now. And they felt very, very betrayed by the fact that NATO expanded, because they felt they had a deal in the 1980s with Gorbachev that that wouldn't happen. And so they're upset about that and have been very clear about that.
Problems that have soured bilateral relations are many, and both sides seem unwilling to back down when it comes to strategic issues. The upcoming talks will probably show whether the two sides are serious enough to resolve their problems.
Leader of the Islamic Revolution, Ayatollah Sayyid Ali Khamenei, has said that one key lesson for future administrations to learn from the experience gained during the tenure of outgoing President Hassan Rouhani is that there is no benefit in putting one's trust in the West. Ayatollah Khamenei made the remarks in a meeting with the members of President Rouhani's administration. He said it was manifested during the tenure of this administration that nothing can be gained from putting one's trust in the West. The leader added that domestic programs should in no way be tied to Western states under any circumstances due to the proven failure of such an approach.
Iran's ballistic missile program and Iran's regional role have nothing to do with the original JCPOA or United Nations Security Council Resolution 2231. They are simply irrelevant. And so to the extent that the United States continues to attempt to utilize maximum pressure to bring in irrelevant issues such as ballistic missiles and Iran's regional role, I believe that we will very soon reach this impasse and that the Raisi administration will bring an end to this charade in Vienna.
Making a reference to the ongoing talks in Vienna, Austria, to revive the 2015 Iran nuclear deal, Ayatollah Khamenei acknowledged that endeavors made by Iranian diplomats, saying, however, that Americans insisted on their hostile stance against Iran and did not move even one step forward during the talks. The leader denounced the U.S. attempts to add new terms to the agreement to push Iran to begin talks on other issues. He said by adding such a clause, the Americans are seeking to gain an excuse for further meddlesome acts regarding Iran's missile program and regional issues.
If the talks in Vienna aren't already at an impasse, I believe that this is where we're going to be heading very soon if the United States continues to refuse to return to its responsibilities and its obligations under the agreement and instead attempts to utilize the illegal terrorist sanctions and maximum pressure campaign of the Trump regime in Vienna to acquire leverage over Iran in the negotiations, specifically regarding issues that have nothing to do with the JCPOA.
Ayatollah Khamenei drew attention to the fact that the U.S. has refused to provide Iran with a guarantee that it will not violate its commitments again. He noted that Washington will not shy away from violating its contractual commitments in the same manner that it did in 2018, a move that was completely costless for them. 6 rounds of negotiations have been held so far in the Austrian capital, Vienna, to revive the Iran nuclear deal, which has come to be known as the Joint Comprehensive Plan of Action or the JCPOA. 3 years ago, the U.S., under former President Donald Trump, withdrew from the Iran nuclear deal and branded what it called the maximum pressure campaign against Iran. Now President Joe Biden, who was the vice president of the United States when the deal was inked, has promised to re-enter the JCPOA and abandon Trump's failed maximum pressure campaign.
Iran's position on the JCPOA and international law has been clear and consistent since the signing of the JCPOA in 2015. And so as such, I don't believe that an incoming Raisi administration or frankly any new incoming Iranian presidential administration would handle the current talks and negotiations any differently.
But so far, he's practically followed footsteps of his predecessor. President-elect Ebrahim Raisi will be officially sworn in on August 5th. Raisi won the June 18 presidential election in a landslide victory, garnering over 18 million votes. It's widely believed that the foreign policy in Iran has a well-established and large-scale framework. When it comes to the issue of the Vienna talks, Iran's policies are not going to change. Therefore, no fundamental changes are expected in the negotiation process under the next administration. However, analysts believe the next administration needs to bolster the national position of Iran to successfully counter the bullying stance of the U.S. and its allies.
Our voice comes from the heart of beautiful Iran. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
ایمان را در خودتون تقویت بکنید، ایمانی که هم در اینجا شما را شرافتمند می کند و هم در پیشگاه حق آبرو دارید و با آبرومندی وارد می شید به تخت اعلی.
In the path of the Imam.
In the name of God, salam and welcome to the program. Imam Khomeini was a religious scholar and a true worshipper and servant of God. If you remember the previous episode, it was said that Imam Khomeini, God's mercy upon him, was very hateful of doing mustahab or recommended acts, although they're not religiously obligatory. You also heard that he was very careful not to do makruh or disapproved acts. The acts that are not haram or forbidden but have been emphasized to refrain from. Today we are going to continue the discussion.